Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 15 of Spill the OT podcast. And today we have a really cool interview with a woman who works in a public school system, but she created a feeding curriculum. So if you are a pediatric therapist, or if you're just thinking about pediatrics or schools, then you might be aware that usually in a public school system, feeding is not really on the table. Get it? But in most public schools, there might be students that have issues with feeding, but they're not necessarily able to get services for that because it doesn't directly affect their academics. And in an IEP, it has to directly affect their academics. So in her school, she was in a pre-K and the feeding behaviors were implementing their ability to participate in snack time. So kind of the younger you are, the more flexibility there is. And it sounds like she was in a pretty intensive classroom with more involved students. So that's why there were students who required feeding on their IEPs. Now, what I think is really cool is she created an entire feeding curriculum. So it's just totally awesome. I don't want to spoil it. So we'll just jump into the interview right away. But before we do, I want to say a big thank you to the people who have rated and reviewed this podcast. So if you could just do me a solid and hit the rate and review and give it a 5-star rating if you're feeling generous. If you don't like this podcast, please don't rate it because it just will make it lower and then it's more difficult to be seen. But if you do like it, hit the 5 stars. And if you're feeling really generous, you can write a review as well. So Pediatric OT wrote, highly recommend this too. And then it says, I really appreciate the honesty in this podcast. I've been an OT for 4 years and have worked in many settings. I love my current setting, but I could never work OT full-time. I'm part-time. I burn out instantly. This podcast doesn't sugarcoat anything, but also interviews some really wonderful OTs. Thank you so much for writing that. And honestly, I really have to give all the credit to the people who are willing to come on here and interview with me. Otherwise, this would be the most boring podcast ever. With that being said, if you would like to be on the podcast, please shoot me an email at spilltheot@gmail.com. And I'd love to have you. Honestly, this podcast is open to everybody. So if you're listening and you're like, oh, I don't know if I should, I don't really know if I have anything I want to say, no big deal. Come on and you can just share whatever experiences that you've had so far, because this is just, you know, your platform as much as anybody else's. Okay, let's jump into the interview. If you have ever thought about learning more about feeding in general, this is just an awesome interview. So here we go.
Yeah, so occupational therapy is actually a second career for me. My undergraduate degree was actually in musical theater. So I tried working a little bit in New York City, starting a theater company and working really hard. And the funny thing is that in order to work in the theater and be successful, I'd say like 99% of the people I knew had to have a day job, you know, to pay the bills, and then would work super hard in their night job in the theater. And so I was no different. I had my day job, like a 9-to-5 office job. And then I would work from 6 until midnight every night in my small theater company. So I quickly realized that this was not sustainable and I didn't have a passion for it. And it kind of just felt like it was going nowhere. But my day job was actually working in human services. So ever since graduating from college, I had sort of this interest and this motivation to be working with people, especially people with developmental disabilities, adults who are deaf or hard of hearing, vision impaired, things like that. So when I sort of decided to give up theater, it was kind of obvious which direction I would go in. But I didn't know anything about OT at that time. So it was kind of like, should I be a nurse? Should I be a doctor? And I started to explore. So I actually went back to school and did what they called a post-bac pre-med to get ready to apply to medical school. So at this point, I was no longer living at home with my parents. You know, I was living on my own and decided to do this, funding it myself. So, you know, took out loans, went to this full-time, year-round program to try and get ready to apply to medical school, and had to work at the same time. So I didn't save any money. It was expensive. And then when I ended up applying to medical school, I did get in, And then I had like some soul searching to do at that point. Both of my parents are actually physicians. So I grew up, you know, knowing a lot about the medical field. But this came at a time when I was also getting married and considering having a family. So it sort of occurred to me that I didn't want for my life to be leaving my family and focusing, you know, 80 to 100 hours a week on a medical career when I could be just as satisfied and helpful to others doing something different. So I sort of had to let that medical school dream go. And it took another couple of years, but I finally landed on OT as a new perspective path. And when I ended up deciding to go to OT school for grad school, I actually had a 2-year-old and a 2-month-old baby at home. So I don't know what I was thinking. I was a little bit crazy, but I took out all the loans and then I had to take extra loans to pay for childcare and really dug myself into a debt hole. But I think it was kind of worth it.
I love your story though. I know that there are a couple listeners, probably more than a couple, who are also second time careers and this is what they've chosen. And I just love to hear like how you came across it. What made you ultimately decide on OT?
Sure. Well, I started sort of volunteering and observing some other professionals that I knew. And since I actually was very well connected with the medical field, I started asking around for, you know, pediatricians and internal medicine docs, you know, for some people who might be good to observe, you know, other careers, physical therapy, speech therapy, OT, you know, even different kinds of technicians. So I really just kind of gave of my time and tried to learn as much as I could. And OT really just sort of sparked that, like, this is it. This is where I can really make a difference.
I love that. That's awesome. So then you went for your master's in OT?
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Well, I love hearing how different people come across it. And your story's really cool. And
Thank you.
Really brave that you did it with 2 kids.
Yeah. I'm not sure brave is the right word. It might be crazy, but yes. When I was through the other end, I looked back and I was able to say, whew, I did it.
I can't even imagine. I really can't. So where have you been working since graduation?
Okay. So I am in my 5th year of practicing as an OT, and I am in my 4th year in the public school system. Right now, I am a full-time OT at an early childhood education center. So my entire caseload is those children coming in from early intervention at age 3 through when they graduate kindergarten at age 5 or 6.
Oh, wow. And it's through the public school system?
It's through the public school system, yes.
Oh, that sounds so sweet. Do you want to touch on those issues we were kind of texting about?
Yeah. So I actually started my 1st year as an OT. I worked in early intervention. And when I was in early intervention, I had the luxury of having a fantastic supervisor, someone who I now hold as like the pinnacle of supervisors who I, you know, aspire to be someday. And so she sort of was a teacher. I mean, I see her as being almost more valuable than a lot of my professors in a way, because she worked with me so one-on-one. And through that relationship with her, I was able to gain so much training and experience with very specific issues such as sensory integration and feeding issues with kids. So when I transitioned into the public schools, the director of special education was asking me, you know, do you happen to have any experience with feeding issues? And I was like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's one of my favorite things to do. And she was like, you know, that's good because we have a huge feeding caseload here. So to me, that was a little bit surprising because going into a public school setting, I assumed that feeding was not something regularly addressed, you know, in a public preschool. But, you know, when I really got into it, I realized that, you know, 75% of my caseload were kids on the autism spectrum or kids who are globally developmentally delayed. And many of them were working on IEP goals around their ability to access snack time and lunchtime similarly to their peers. So I sort of realized that I had a big job cut out for me in that way. It's too many students to provide one-on-one feeding therapy to, and not necessarily appropriate to do that in a public school. So I ended up taking probably 80 to 100 hours of my own time, evenings and weekends, to try and research and develop a new curriculum that I could implement to sort of address many of their needs in a more naturalistic setting. So I just sort of delved into this, and luckily for me, I had a student at the time. She was actually an undergrad, but applying to OT school and trying to get her her observation hours in. And otherwise, I really wouldn't have been able to do all this research. So she helped me pull whatever research on feeding, interventions with ASD kids, interventions appropriate for school settings. And it turned out there really wasn't that much that was directly addressing what I wanted to do. But we pulled little pieces from here, little pieces from there, and were able to sort of compile a list of best practices or pieces of best practices that we could use and adapt to make it appropriate for our setting. And then I set about, having never made or developed a curriculum of any type before, I had no idea what I was doing, but I just set out to, the best I could, lay out my findings and to develop a curriculum. And I wrote it into a paper as a proposal for my school district so that they would actually pay for it. Because up until then, all of the interventions I had been doing with these kids around feeding were funded totally by me, just like, you know, looking up what I needed on Amazon or on eSpecial Needs and ordering it myself. So I kind of was spending a fortune and wanted that to stop. So I submitted this proposal to the district, and I got approval for this program to run fully funded by the school. So, whew, that was like a huge load taken off my shoulders. And it sort of occurred to me that before I start implementing this this new curriculum intervention, that I really needed to take some data in order so that I could prove to the district that it was effective so we could keep it running. So then I endeavored to try and develop this data collection tool, basically, that would give me a baseline on all of our students. And it went through several renditions. So this is, you know, you wanted to know what was good and what was bad. But what was bad was definitely I started with a data collection form that wasn't so useful for us. But through trial and error and through asking all of my other, you know, team members and the teachers and the paraprofessionals, what was helpful, what was not so helpful, finally by like the fifth or sixth rendition of this data collection sheet, we finally landed on something that was helpful to everyone. But we saw kind of incredible results with our intervention. So I was really glad that we went through the trouble of really documenting every little thing, because we were able to chart it at the very end and see the growth. And not that I was going to do anything with that information, maybe I should, but just, you know, personally, professionally, to have that visual to look at, it was kind of incredible to me.
I feel like this whole story is pretty incredible. I have so many questions for you.
Sure.
So to start off, when you have students who have goals in feeding, were they specifically listed for OT, or was that just part of their whole IEP?
So most of the time, what we do for our littlest students is we try to make it as multidisciplinary as possible, or transdisciplinary. So if a child has an ADL goal on their IEP, they will have their special educator and their OT, and in some cases, their speech therapist or their physical therapist attached to that goal. But I'd say the majority of the time, it's the OT and the special education teacher working together on the ADL goals. And those goals really center around participation and appropriate mealtime behavior and independence. So they're not the type of goals you would see in an outpatient, like a feeding clinic. So that's kind of important to make that differentiation. We're not working on chewing, we're not working on swallowing, we're not really working on bolus management, things like that, but we are more focused on that social and independence piece that comes with really increasing that that tolerance for mealtime.
And while this was going on, would you also have more traditional OT goals like pre-writing or those?
Absolutely, yes. So there you're touching on sort of the issue that I came into was that all of these kids had OT specific goals, you know, around being able to access their manipulatives and their pre-writing and all of that, you know, and then there's this other ADL piece that I was responsible for. And, you know, with the service delivery being traditionally, you know, once or twice a week for 30 minutes, how in the world do you address all of these goals?
Yeah, I have no idea. So yeah, So what did you do?
So the curriculum we came up with, it is basically a family style dining experience. The intention is that it will be implemented every day. So that's 5 days. Some of the kiddos that I work with are actually only in a 3-day preschool program. So then it would just be, you know, adapted for their 3-day program. But the vast majority of these kiddos are there full time. So five full days of preschool. So this should be implemented at the same time every day. It's just part of the schedule of the classroom. And we call it Snack Pack, just to be sort of like a cute little motivating event for these kids. So snack time typically is around 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the classroom. So whatever the natural snack time would be for the kiddos, that's when they would come to Snack Pack. And Snack Pack is it's about a half an hour long experience where the kids, and this should be mostly the special ed kids that have feeding goals, but we always make it a point to have one to two feeding models at the table as well. And whoever is at the table has to participate. So whatever staff members are there have to be participating in the snack itself, not just facilitating, so that you get this more community-based sort of meal experience. And there's so much focus on the behavior and the participation around feeding that we don't even get to eating until about the last 10 minutes. The kids get to sort of experience this ritual and routine around washing their hands, setting the table, and everybody gets to help out. We find that the kids, if they're engaged in the preparations for snack, then they're a lot more motivated to be part of the snack. So we'll have the kids pour the snack into cups. We'll have the kids mix it up. We'll have the kids pass out the utensils and the bowls and the napkins. We pass around a communal pitcher of water, and all of the kids have to pour their own cup. Now, of course, a lot of these kids with global developmental delays, they really can't, but we don't hold them to any standard of neatness. So as long as the child tries, then that counts. And then their adult can help to facilitate the rest of their pour. And we find that the kids are kind of encouraging each other too. Like they will all count for each other so they can pour for the count of three. And everyone at the table will go 1, 2, 3, and they'll put the pitcher down. If we're stirring up snack, the kids will count for each other. And they even start to say, you know, good job to their friend when they see them doing what they're expected to do.
I love this.
So all of this is very sort of motivating for them to come to the table. And we haven't even introduced yet the concept that they're supposed to be eating.
Hey, everybody. I am so genuinely excited to tell you about MedBridge. So MedBridge is a continuing ed site, and they have tons of continuing ed courses all available online. You can stream them at your own pace. They also have home exercise plans, which are incredible. You can literally build your own plan with pictures that can perfectly suit whatever client you're working for. It's honestly so awesome. And you get unlimited CEUs. And these CEU courses are just really intriguing and exciting. Like I've done continuing ed online in the past, and these ones that they select are just very much in line with what I find interesting, and I feel like you might find them interesting as well. So, are you struggling with finding the resources for your time for CEUs? With almost 2,000 accredited evidence-based streaming courses, live CEU webinars, MedBridge is your all-in-one solution. And actually, if you use my code, it's SPILLTHEOT, capital S, capital T, capital OT. So spill the OT, one word, capital S, capital T, capital OT. You can get $175 off of your year-long subscription, which is awesome. I mean, that's like significant amount of money off. So if you are interested, please go check it out. Again, use the code spill the OT, capital S, capital T, capital OT, all one word. All right. I really hope that you go check it out. Enjoy.
I find that about 50% of the kids that we work with in our feeding intervention groups, really their feeding delays have come from trauma of some sort. So the thought of sitting them down and shoving food in their face is just so re-traumatizing for them that one of the first things we teach all of the adults in the room is it's not about eating.
It almost sounds like a Montessori school.
You know, it could be thought of a little bit like that. We sort of have structured it based on the principles of SOS. I don't know if you're familiar with the sensory oral sequential program. We used an early intervention. And this is an idea. This was developed by Dr. Kay Toomey. And basically the principle is there's a hierarchy to learning how to eat from a sensory perspective. It starts with the ability to see, to tolerate looking at a food, to tolerate smelling a food, to tolerate touching a food. And you go through all of these steps. And really the last step in this hierarchy is being able to chew and swallow the food. So each one of these sessions, after the kids have prepared and they've passed out their snacks and they've poured their water, is introducing a game. So the game will be something like, if we have alphabet crackers, we're going to be, you know, guessing the letters of the game. Or if we have Cheerios, we're going to be stringing the Cheerios onto a pipe cleaner. There's some kind of game that involves looking and touching and smelling, and there's no expectation of eating at that point. Now, of course, some of the kids are just going to grab the food and put it in their mouth, which is fantastic. But most of the kids, if we were to ask them to take a bite, would turn their chair around, or they would get up and leave, or they would throw a fit. So I really like to engage them in this game first, where they get to learn that the food is not scary and that the food can be sort of part of their regular play. And then in the very last, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, we can go around and ask people to stick out their tongue and touch the food or give the food a kiss on their lips. And what happens is, if we're all done with snack and somebody has not interacted with their food, then that's just fine. They get to clean up just like everybody else. And then they go through these other rituals of putting all of their food on their plates and taking their plates to the trash and then washing their hands, a community effort to get everyone to clean and be finished. So I think as the kids start to understand that there's no expectation, then they come to the table more freely and they participate more freely. And some of that anxiety is decreased.
Wow, this just sounds so incredible. So at the end, there's no expectation that somebody has to eat. It's just that they are engaging throughout the whole session.
Correct.
So I feel like that must help with the behaviors and just the overall anxiety and stress, because you're taking that pressure off of them.
Right. That's sort of the idea.
I love it. Like, I know the whole goal is so that kids don't have to end up on a G-tube. Do you have any kids that are at risk who, you know, they're very close to the family having to decide whether or not to put them on some sort of accessory feeding?
Yes. So I actually have kids who are at risk, but then I do have some children that are currently using G-tubes, and we're working with them to decrease the dependence on that method of feeding and to increase the ability to orally feed. So sort of, I mean, the kids really run the gamut from all levels of feeding dependence. And we have seen it make a difference. Definitely. I have one girl that I'm thinking of who came to us on a feeding tube, who started with needing 3 feeds throughout the course of her school day. And after a year of being with us in the program, she was down to 1 feed throughout the day. And now she's not getting any feeds during her school day through the tube. She's taking all of her nutrition orally.
Wow, that's incredible.
It's pretty cool to see that growth.
That's amazing. So who's actually providing the intervention? Are you there, or are you more of a consultant that, you know, created and now organizes this program?
Yeah. So at the very beginning, I was there every day And that was really to provide modeling and teaching to the other staff that was going to be there with the goal of being able to step back and let this run itself. So we're at that point now where this program runs itself with the help of a special education teacher and about four paraprofessionals. Mm-hmm. And all of them, the teacher and the paraprofessionals, sit at the table with the students and actually eat the snack with them.
Wow, this is so cool. How do you decide like what snacks you're going to feed?
Sure, that is a great question. So I have generated a list of snacks, breaking them up by category. And so the categories that we've established are things that fall into the crunchy or salty category. And those are things like pretzels and veggie straws, pirate's booty, goldfish, sort of those foods that are a little bit easier to tolerate for most kids, especially those kids on the spectrum who come to us, you know, maybe only having tolerance for pretzels and goldfish. Another category is dry or sweet snacks. And those are things like graham crackers or animal crackers, some cereals. They can even be like a granola bar, which is a little bit more complex, but still falls into that category. Another category is chewy or resistive foods. And that's things like dried mango, or that fruit leather, like string cheese even. Another category is like thick and wet foods like applesauce or pudding. Sometimes we do hummus. And then the last category are those foods that have really intense flavor, like really spicy or really sour. And so we'll do like the hot and spicy Cheez-Its or like a barbecue flavor potato chip. And surprisingly, some of the favorites have actually been like sour gummy worms or like Sour Patch Kids.
That is surprising.
Yeah, it is. I know. But the kids actually, yeah, you know, sometimes we do spicy salsa and the kids actually really like that too. So the concept is at every snack pack time, two different snacks are offered. And one would come from a safe category, like a pretzel or a graham cracker, something that's more widely tolerated. And then the second option comes from something that's a little less tolerated, like pudding or cheese, something that, you know, is a little bit more complex, so that the kids get to, at least if they're eating something that's safe, you know, they're getting that feeling of being full, but they're still being exposed to something that's more challenging.
Is the expectation that they put both snacks on their plate?
Yes. So as we're passing, you know, snacks around, the kids will help each other get served, or the kids will serve themselves from, you know, a common bowl. And everybody starts out with both options on their plate. Some of the kids will automatically just push something off or throw it on the floor, and we don't even react. We just let that happen. Some of the kids have learned to take their chocolate pudding and paint on the table with it instead of eating it. And that's absolutely okay too.
So I know that you were talking about your data collection tool. Who is actually taking the data?
Sure. So one of the paraprofessionals that is participating in the group will fill out the data form for me. At first, we were taking data every day, but now we just take data once a week. And the things that we are really targeting on our data sheet, it's sort of a two-pronged approach here. We're looking for two different outcomes. The first thing we're measuring is the participation level. So will the child participate in washing hands, pouring water, serving snack, and then to what degree of independence? So we'll rate them as being independent or needing min, moderate, or max assist with that. And then the second thing we're looking for is to expand the food repertoire for these kids. So similar to how we rate the participation behaviors, we will rate their tolerance for the foods. So if the child refuses, you know, that's on one end. And if they're independently eating it, that's on the other end of the scale.
Okay. Do you feel like you get a lot of parent buy-in? Has that been a barrier or something?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. The parents have by and large been really excited with the results that are occurring in school. And many of the parents noticed that home mealtime behaviors have increased as well. The thing that I really struggle with though is getting the carryover at home. So there was a lot, especially in the beginning, there was a lot of parent education going into, you know, these are the things we're doing in the classroom that work. And, you know, if you can do them at home, and these are very simple things in my mind, but for some families, they're really not so simple, such as staying seated during the entire mealtime, having no technology around during mealtime, you know, things like that, that just seem so simple to some of us, but are actually changing whole family rituals and routines, and can be quite challenging for some of my families.
Did you say that parents have noticed the behaviors increase at home?
The positive feeding behaviors have increased. So participation in mealtime, engagement has increased for them.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant the negative behaviors, but then I was able to see why that might make sense if any negative behaviors occurred at home, because they probably like how it's being done at school and they don't know how to communicate, like, hey, let's try this at home too.
Right.
Now, has this curriculum influenced how the team writes your ADL and feeding goals on the IEP?
Yes, actually it has. It sort of clarifies what the objective should be. So we've stopped writing objectives around food repertoire, and that just becomes sort of like an added bonus. And what we're really targeting is the participation level. And that sort of helps to make things more measurable when it comes to, you know, progress monitoring for the IEP.
Okay. So now that this is in place, do you feel like there's more of a balance and you can focus on those more traditional OT areas?
It's actually fantastic now that the paraprofessionals have been able to take it over. So now I'm just consult with, you know, with these kids around their feeding, and I don't have to be so hands-on. Of course, there's going to be a couple of kids that really need some one-on-one OT intervention, but by and large, most of the kids' needs in this area are addressed just through their regular special education service delivery.
Are you the only program within your district that's doing this, or has this spread throughout other schools?
So we are the only preschool and kindergarten in our district. So the whole district comes to the same school for preschool and kindergarten. And as far as I know, none of the elementary schools do anything related to feeding. One of my concerns, though, is that we have such a big cohort of these kids who are on the spectrum right now in preschool, that eventually they are going to end up in the elementary schools. So I hope that, you know, by the time that happens, we're able to sort of reach out to the elementary schools and generate some sort of carryover for them. Because if not, I do sort of worry that some of these kids who have made a lot of progress might start to go backwards. But for some of the kids also, you know, maybe just getting over that initial hurdle and realizing that food doesn't have to be scary. For some of them, they'll just continue to progress on their own without intervention. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be a good goal for us going forward to definitely initiate some sort of carryover there for these kids when they go to first grade.
I mean, I feel like so many schools could adopt this model. It makes so much sense, and it just will help eliminate a lot of stress for a lot of kiddos out there.
I do feel like if I had any time built into my schedule for doing things like research, I could maybe make this into something written, you know, that I could submit that other people could use. But right now I feel like it's so tough to help it go anywhere just because I don't, you know, I'm not given that time. So I have to find that time somehow.
Well, I'm just so impressed by everything that you've done so far. To create this whole thing is really incredible.
Oh, thank you.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share regarding feeding with people?
Not that I can think of. We covered a lot, didn't we?
We really did. You have so much to share. I feel like I could see you as someone who could like teach courses on this.
Oh my gosh. Someday maybe.
Yeah, it's really cool. So a question that I ask everybody is, if you could do it all again, would you go into OT?
Absolutely, without a doubt. I think it was the best decision I've ever made.
Wow, that's awesome. This has been such a positive interview. I love it.
Oh, good. I think what you're doing with this podcast is incredible. I really like, you know, the fact that now I can listen to other OTs and hear what they're doing. And it just might make some people feel less isolated in their field, I think. So that's really great.
Oh, thank you. I was just having such a hard time deciding what niche I wanted to work in. And I kept switching jobs. And I was like, you know what? I really need to just talk to other people before I keep trying out all these different niches without, you know, deciding what works for me.
Mm-hmm. So have you made any, come to any conclusions from listening to everyone's stories?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. I'm like a lost puppy, but I'll find my way.
Well, I think one of the best things about OT is there are endless possibilities with who you can work with and where you can work and who your primary stakeholders can be. So I want to wish you luck in finding what it is that you're going to do, but there's so many choices.
You're so right. And it really is encouraging when you think of it that way. So thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. But thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. This was fun.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. That's it, folks. Thanks so much for listening. And I did get a question about productivity, particularly about productivity in schools. So I'm collecting a little bit of data from my Instagram as well as Facebook groups to just get an idea of what productivity standards you guys face out in the field. So I will list that next week once I get a couple more people that have answered it. So as always, if you would like to follow me on Instagram, it's spill_the_OT. And if you would like to come on the show, it's spilltheot@gmail.com. All right, bye.